Good evening, one and all. Yeah, it's another Wednesday, and this is me, Barry, here in Connecticut, where the temperature, well, the heat wave is finally looked like it's going to break tomorrow. I was just saying to my guests, we've had 19 days in July where the temperature's been over 90 here in Connecticut. A little bit warm, but it's not just here. It's been warm in England, where my guest is today. They actually had the highest ever temperature in England, I think, this last week, 101.7, something like that, in old money, that is. I don't know why, but ask me what it is in the new stuff. About 38, something like that. Anyway, and he is there. Now, talking about him being there, because we've had, in the 6 or 7 years that we've had this show online, people contacting us from some very interesting places, restaurants being pulled in by the police at the side of the road, all sorts of stuff like that going on. We once had a werewolf dial into the show. Well, my guest today, he was a bit worried about his signal on his phone. So he found the best place was near the local prison. So it's midnight and he's hanging around near a local prison on the phone. So if you hear the sirens go off, you know what's going on. Well, what can I tell you about my guest today? He's been on the show a couple of times before, and he has been mentioned lots of times before, especially when we're talking about historical things and stuff like that, because, well, we'll start chatting with him, because on the show today, I've got my mate, the one and only Peter Burke. Hi, Pete, how are you doing?
Hello, Barry. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay, mate. I'm doing okay. Now, as I said, you've been on the show before about this, and we've had all sorts of, you know, you've come up under all sorts of things. Steve Berry, when he comes on, we sort of talk about what's been going on, and I've given people updates of what's going on. But it all started, I believe, Pete, when you were sort of doing some investigation whilst writing a trilogy of books or something, wasn't it, when you first came across this theory?
Yeah, it was a myth. It was classified as a myth. It was the story that Harold survived the Battle of Hastings in 1066. Now this I used in the trilogy, the Promise trilogy. I was writing a few years ago, and the story was that Harold got away. He was repaired by a Moorish or an Arab nurse, and survived until his old age in Chester.
Wow. Because I know, you know, you've written this, the 1066, The Lie, which is something which is, you know, it bases back on this sort of monkish thing in, well, Waltham Abbey, as we know it is, that Harold Godwinson, as he really was known, didn't die. It was, as you say, a version of the myth, Chester the Hermit, I think, or something like that, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, because what I did when I finished writing my novels, something worried me, because I was, you know, like all writers, they want to be as near the truth as they can, even though it's fiction. And I really wanted this story about Harold to join me books up, to link the three books, and so it had to be plausible. But the problem was, once I'd finished writing the trilogy, I worried about it, because it was plausible, and I set out to try and disprove the myth, to make sure that I could actually put the thing down and move on with something else. Mm-hmm. But the more I dug, the more I found there was truth in what this old story told us. Now, it was hidden in the abbey for 400 years. It was hidden by the monks and by the priests, but they used to use it for their own personal reading. And it seems strange to me, why would you hide a book for 400 years? You know, why all that time, and why wasn't it revealed? But when I found out and we'd started digging, I remarried. Mm-hmm. And my wife, I'm married, she was a researcher. And she worked with MI5, well, she worked with the military intelligence for a few years. And she's very good at what she does. And we joined the forces and we started to dig. And she was digging up in Shropshire. I was digging down south. And we was looking for anything we could find. Well, we came across one particular document dated from the 13th century in Latin. And luckily enough, I've got a friend who's a professor of Latin. In Liverpool, and he translated it for me, and this gave us the key that moved us into such of this, a brand new door opened up before us, and we suddenly found ourselves looking at the absolute proof that Harold did survive.
Yeah, see,
a phenomenal research.
Yeah, like a lot of things, like a lot of things in history, it's hearsay. And in this case, in the case of the Battle of Hastings, the only real of anything we've got is the Boyer Tapestry, and there's bits missing, or a bit at least missing from that. And yeah, that was sort of done umpteen years later by the French. So yeah, and that's what we go as our history being the truth, and as we found out with Richard III and several other bits and pieces, you know, truth, what we believe is the truth quite often isn't. You just got to look at America here, and oh, Columbus was the first one here. No, it's not. There was people from China and Egypt and you know, all sorts of places, you know, in America way before Columbus. You know, the Stone Age moved from the French, from France. The other ones came from Russia. You know, it's not like that. And but you went on, and as you say, that this door was opened, and what did that lead you to?
Well, when we looked at we got our friend Jim, the Latin professor, we got him to translate the Latin document, but we asked him, because we know that the Latin isn't a simple language, it's got nuances, it's got innuendo that is written into the pieces, and it's the way that Latin is spelt out and written that gives you an idea of the true story of what he's trying to say. So we got him to do the work on that. He came back with something. When we read it, it was a real eye-opener, because it meant that we had a job to do. We had to go searching because what we found was that there was a document that was disputed by all historians, and they said, no, this can't be true, because Harold and his brother Gurth, they both died at Hastings. So when you get historians that do that, they don't search. They don't look any further. They just say, oh, that's a myth, just pass it off.
Yeah,
we don't use that. I picked it up and I looked at it. What Gurth said in a conversation with Henry I, William's son.
Yeah.
Henry I asked him, "Was it true about your brother?" Now there was this meeting in Woodstock near Oxford in 1124, right at the end of Gurth's life. Now, Gurth fought with Harold at Hastings, and all the historians say he died there with his other brother, Leifrin. Well, this particular document was such a puzzle, because it gave us suddenly an eye-opener as to what if it wasn't as history told us?
Yeah.
What if Gurth survived? And what I looked at was what Gurth said. Now, when he spoke to Henry I, Henry said to him, "Were the rumours true that your brother survived?" And he said, yes, he did. And he said, he first appeared with us, that was the family of Gurth and Harold's, part of Harold's family, in near Duburgham, which is Canterbury. It was a place near there. And he said, and he worked there performing sacrifices, cleansing sacrifices.
Yeah.
So he was doing cleansing work after the battle. This was many years later, because he spent about 10 years abroad in Germany and down to Jerusalem and back again. And when he came back, Gurth said that he stayed there for a long while with us, but then because the popularity of him grew, many people realized who he was and they came to see him, and so he withdrew himself from us. And the last we heard was that he had finished his time in Chester. So that we thought... He had some words he used in that document that Jim brought out, the Latin team. And he said, the things you look for are a certain rock, he said, cleansing sacrifices, a cave, and this was what we was going for. So we went down to Canterbury, me and my wife, with no hope of finding anything. You know, you go down to a place a thousand years later and you're thinking, we have no chance of finding anything from what this Gurth said. But with research, we went in there and we was looking around. We were saying to ourselves, everything has changed so much. We're looking for a rock. Where are we going to find a rock? All Canterbury is flat.
Yeah.
And then on the way back, we spent the day. It was a lovely day, and we had a nice cup of coffee. And yeah. And when we actually said to ourselves, look, we've just asked someone here. And we was in a cafe, and I spoke to the lady behind the bar, and she said, I wouldn't know anything about that. But she said, I know someone that might. My husband's a historian.
Oh, that's good, yeah.
He walked in behind us, an old chap with a big beard.
Yep.
And I just said to him, I said, look, you probably won't know, but I'm looking for somewhere around here that is called a rock, where there was a cave and where cleansing sacrifices were performed. And straight away he says, there's two places. One is the old cathedral. He said, but that's not in use. And the water from the spring there was used to feed the cathedral, so that wouldn't be there. Yeah. He said, but go out of town, a mile out of town, there is a place where the pilgrims stop. They wash themselves, cleanse themselves before they come into Canterbury.
Yes,
he said,
yes.
There's a place there. There used to be a cave. So we went up there very excited. We found not only that Henry I actually knew this place because he had donated land and forest to this place. Mm. There was a hospital there that served lepers.
Wow.
This one of the first leper hospitals in England. And this was a place where lived a herbalist. Now, this herbalist was dealing with special herbs that were only known to come from this place near Canterbury. This herbalist was a woman, and she was collecting stuff from Europe, and everyone who wanted healing came from all over England to this one place. It was known as a place of healing.
Wow.
Now, when we looked at all this, and we look at the book from the Waltham Abbey, the book that was hidden about Harold's life,
yep.
The Vita Heraldi, it said he was cured by a Moorish nurse.
Yes, yes.
So we put that together. We thought, this could be the herbalist's place.
Yeah.
But when we looked at the histories around it, we realised, too, that this was this hospital was built on a limestone hill. And during Henry I's time, he said, I'll donate all this money to this so your church can be, your hospital and church can be looked after. He said, but I want all you people that work here to clear all this rock because I want it to stand out. And what that place became to be known locally as was the rock.
Right.
So when Henry I spoke with Gurth, Harold's brother, Gurth said to him, there's a certain rock. And Jim said the way the nuance went in that Latin, he said that how Henry I knew about this place, and Gurth knew that he knew.
Because he'd given the land and everything, yeah.
So we sort of went back there. We went home and had a good think about it, did some research. Then we went back and we uncovered a wall painting of a Moorish lady with a herb book in her hand.
Wow.
And it's still there today.
Wow.
And we think, that's the link. That's because when you follow a trail and you find nothing, you can very often say you're going the wrong direction.
Yeah.
When you follow a trail and things start popping up, you think, this is unbelievable.
And actually, you
found the nurse.
Exactly. I mean, and you followed on from there, didn't you? I mean, you were looking for the grave, and didn't you find that the cross or something in that had been missing for 400 years or something?
Yeah, no, that's, that was, I'd like to say it was me, but my wife spotted that. We were looking at, we had the people down that found found Richard III.
Yeah.
The people, the sumo people, they're the people that use this sonar equipment. So they scanned the whole area of the east wall. We found an unmarked grave exactly where the marks in the stone, because of being a stonemason, that's originally what I used in my trilogy, was the fact that there were these strange markings in this 11th century section of wall at the east end of the church. And I kept saying there's something special here because a mason wouldn't just leave marks willy-nilly.
No. That's a code.
Yeah. When they'd done the scan, they found the unmarked grave, which I'm sure is Harold. And but when we was looking at the scan after, my wife looked at it. She said, well, what are these three things? And there's three large stones under the ground just beneath the Lady Chapel. And when I scaled them, I asked these sumo people, the archaeologists, I said, how accurate are your drawings? They said, to within maybe a a centimetre, maybe 2 centimetres. I said, that's good enough, because I took a drawing of each of these, I cut them out the sections and put them together, and the actual shape of it made the cross. Now, when you look at the Vita Heraldi again, there's a fairly good description of the cross, and it was a cross that was brought to the abbey by Tovi the Proud, in about 1032. And he found it. It was life size, so it would have been a fairly big lump of like a marble or black stone. Mm-hmm. He found near Glastonbury, and they brought it up, and it was worshipped in the cross, and that's what they called the Holy Cross. But obviously, in the Reformation, with Henry VIII's people, they went around and they started smashing churches up.
Yeah.
But being a Mason as well, I looked at how these stones are broken, and it appeared to me that if you topple a cross that is around 9 foot tall, weighs about 13 tons, and you push it over, which would be quite hard in itself, it would smash on the flagstones, and it would break a certain way. And when I put these pieces together, it snapped exactly how I thought it would.
Wow, so it got pushed over, yeah.
Yeah. And then what they did, because it was so, each lump was probably about 4 or 5 tons, so it would have been far too heavy for the monks at that time to bury it, to move it.
Yeah.
So I think just took up they dug the ground out where they were and buried
it underneath. Is this the cross then that Harold prayed before the Battle of Hastings or something like that?
That's it. Yeah, the same one. Yeah.
Wow.
It's a stone, black stone. But they think that it was encrusted with gems and gold. I mean, if anyone digs it up, it's only about half a meter deep. But if anyone digs it up, you don't know what you might find. There might be gold. There might be all sorts of treasures around it, because it was well thought of. And the queens that came there, all of them, they used to make offerings of like their jewelry and their stones and stick them to the cross.
Now, Pete, the thing is, obviously, you know, you think, where that Harold's buried there, but yeah. And the cross is here and that. But obviously, the thing is, and I know there's, you know, you've been working with TV people and stuff like that along the way. It's sacred ground, to get permission to open this grave or whatever up. You know, that's the hardest part, I'm guessing.
Yeah, that is the sticking point. And that's one of the reasons we want the documentary to go ahead, because it may put pressure on them. I mean, I think ultimately it's the Secretary of State that takes the last decision. But if we could get enough public opinion behind us, and there's no reason why it can't be. I mean, it's they've had drains they've cut out across here. They've renewed the drainage areas. So they've done work to that place, but they haven't done any work where these items are.
Yeah, I mean, Time Team used to do it all the time, didn't they? You know,
I know. Well, we got Tony Robinson working with us on the next thing. So.
Oh, good.
So him and his friend Mark, they're working out how to set the documentary up so that it gets the most impact.
Right.
So when that happens, hopefully we'll have a bit of public behind us, and we may get someone's arm up their back and get
See, the thing is, I mean, it's the same as this whole business, like I said, with Columbus over here, and you know, there's two or three blokes on TV doing these truth about America and that, and there's pyramids here, there's the Great Wall, equivalent of the Great Wall of China here, there's tombs, there's all sorts here, you know, but they hide it. Because they don't want to, you know, because, you know, if it's proven that he didn't die, then the whole of the royal line is illegal, and it's the same over here. You know, all of history books have to be changed and stuff like that. But in the meantime, I believe you started work on something else, Pete.
Yeah, I've this would drive me nuts, to be honest. I mean, I'll just be pleased. I love this story, and it's such an exciting time for us. But I write things, and I want to get on with other stories. I've got a trilogy coming out, hopefully early next year, of the lives of three lads from Barnet. All totally different, all different circumstances, but a lot of them based on around true events as well. I'm hoping that as soon as I get this documentary out of the way, I can actually just sit down and finish these off. I want them done by the end of the year.
Right.
So I know how you coming from Barnet as well would be interesting.
Yeah, see, people don't realise. I mean, some people have heard the name Barnet in history because of the Battle of Barnet. Obviously, the deciding war in the War of the Roses, where Warwick the Kingmaker met his end. But it's got a lot of other places. If you look at Cockney rhyming slang, Barnet Fair, you hear. Barnet Fair was one of the biggest sort of horse trading thing in Europe, more or less, wasn't it, I think, at one time? And when we were growing up, it wasn't part like it is now. It's just basically extension of London, but you know it was country. I mean,
we had woods. The horse fair on one side of Barnet Lane, and we had the pleasure fair on the other side.
The highlight of a year, that was a brilliant time. I mean, and you know, we're looking at sort of 50s, early 60s sort of thing like that, and you've got to remember that was like 2-3 years, you know, the early 50s when I was born. It's only 3 years after the war ended. I was looking at a thing I downloaded the other day. I found where all the a map of where bombs fell through Barnet. Places, and places you don't even think, down the park,
no,
so people can imagine growing up in those times. You're basically on a bomb site, with lots of new houses. It's a totally different world, wasn't it?
Yeah, we had where we used to get the sticklebacks to go fishing.
Oh my goodness, Cat Hill.
That was a bomb crater.
Yeah. Oh crikey, newts and sticklebacks. That's right. Yeah. But I mean, and the thing. Doing it like you are with the sort of three different people, Barnet is a pretty eclectic mix. Even in those days, you've got Fryan Barnet, New Barnet, High Barnet, Chipping Barnet, East Barnet, and Barnet. I mean, if people say Barnet, that's the borough. So you've got all those places. I mean, you look at New Barnet and you look at East Barnet, totally different people, totally different places. Yeah. And of course, in the 60s, it was mods and rockers, you know, the early, the mods and rockers. I mean, it must be really interesting for you, because I know you got some stories yourself. It must be really interesting.
Yeah, we was interesting children in days. It's only when you look back you realise how lucky we are to survive.
Oh my goodness, yes.
we just went out and had fun as kids do, but it was a little bit like Lord of the Flies, you know. It was a little bit dangerous as well. When I think of some of the tricks we used to pull, and that's why I'm thinking writing about it. I was in two minds, because I think it's not a very good example to my grandkids.
Yeah.
At the same time, like my dad said, the stories that people have inside them that die when they die. And I just thought, well, you know, we're at that age now. I just want to get these down.
That's funny you said that, because there's been a definite increase the last couple of years, Pete. There's been an increase in the number of people who've come on the show and who've been writing down their parents' or their grandparents' stories. You know, there was a bloke, somebody who was the only survivor from a bomber and walked from where it crashed in Germany back to Spain and stuff. Or the people who escaped from prisoner of war camp 3 or 4 times and all. You know, these stories. Or the other thing is the Japanese that are interned in internment camps in America. You know, these sort of things. Yeah. People are telling their stories because it's going to get lost, as you say.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and it's a period of history. I mean, we do say that we like to keep the histories as clear as we can, but it relies on people actually telling their stories to get this clear.
Yeah.
So, you know, otherwise, we're getting one person's version of a whole load of events.
Yeah.
And really, we want the ordinary person telling their stories. That's what we want.
I think, and it really does seem that people are finally realising that, and that more and more people are, and it's too late in a lot of cases, obviously. Yeah, but it's to hear some of the stuff I've heard this last couple of years, you know, it's, and I think I understand quite a bit that went on, you know, in the war and the Holocaust camps and stuff like that. But you hear some of these people, and we don't know a fraction of it, Pete. We just don't.
No, we don't. No. Well, no, we're grateful for those that have told us the story.
Oh,
though.
Too right. I mean, you know, they say lest we forget, and we can't forget this stuff. And it's the same with all history. We've got to keep it there, and we are continuing to discover new things every year that we didn't know about, and that. So, before I hand the show over to you, Pete, what's the latest then on the Harold stuff? You're just getting the information together and planning the documentary.
Yeah, we've got it all planned out. Tony and Mark, it's Mark Billingham. He's a crime writer for the BBC.
Right.
He's a friend of Tony's. They're both working on it. They're going to do like a crime scene investigation type.
Okay.
It'll be quite entertaining though. But Tony is going to be the one that disbelieves everything, and Mark's going to be the one that shows him the evidence. So it's going to work like that.
Great stuff. Oh, so
we're just waiting for a slot, that's all.
Great. Well, Pete, thank you so much for being on the show. But time is beating us, mate, and I know it's getting late for you over there. But what I'm going to do now is hand the show over to you, and so you can tell everybody where people can find out more about you and your books and the information, you know, what you're doing, etc. So over to you.
Oh, thanks, Barry. Well, I think basically, the best thing to do is to look on Amazon under Peter Burke, The Promise. The trilogy's there, The Promise, The King's Sword and The Bone Cartouche. They're the three books that started all this off. And when the 1066, The Lie, when that's published properly after the show, after the documentary, then that will go back on the same site probably. Once you click on The Promise, Peter Burke, you'll see these other books will come up as well.
Great. Well, Pete, thank you so much for being on the show. Great to chat to you again. Next time I come over, we'll have a pint, mate. But
definitely.
Great. Good luck, and I'll keep following, and I'll keep telling everybody any news that comes through about the documentary, etc. And thank you so much.
No problem. Thanks, Barry.
Right. Well, there you go. My guest today, Peter Burke. Mate of mine, great to have him back on the show to find out the information. Peter Burke is Burke, and as he said, the new bit that he's got, 1066 The Lie, which will be coming out after this documentary. People don't know Time Team was a thing on TV for many years on BBC, where they had 3 days to do an archaeological dig, and wonderful stuff, great stuff indeed. In fact, they did a dig in St Osyth, where I was meant to be moving to in England. Meant to, I say, not happening. But great, it's fascinating this the way history changes, isn't it? Well, that's it for now. I'll be back on Sunday with my Those Were the Days music from the 20th century, and we're up to 1980, I think. It hits the summer 1980 this week. Followed, of course, after that by 30 minutes of the British invasion. And then I'll be back next Tuesday with fresh guests here on A Book and a Chat. But until then, as always, we have one thing left to say. Don't forget...